Varicosity Vein Center, providing vein treatment relief for vein disease, spider veins, and varicose veins for over 20 years. Their team of doctors and vein specialists deliver techniques and care for residents in Jackson, Madison, Ridgeland, and Central Mississippi. Information and appointment scheduling at varicosityveincenter.com.
This is an MPB Think Radio podcast. To hear previous shows, visit mpbonline.org or download the MPB Public Radio app to listen on your iPhone or Android phone on demand.
Deep South Dining is the show all about the culture of Southern flavor, from fried chicken and collard greens to shrimp and grits and a glass of sweet tea. Subscribe now to the podcast using any podcast app or download our MPB Public Media app.
Okie dokie, folks. Welcome back. Horticulture's Phil DeRushing, and I am glad to be talking with you about gardening. I haven't been doing much the past week because I've been traveling. Gaba, you know where I am, don't you, man?
Lancashire.
I'm from Lancashire. That's right, northern England. You've been in Mississippi in the summertime, right?
And I know why you go to Lancashire.
Yeah, heck with that. I mean, it got up to 72 yesterday. And I'm not bragging at all. I'm over here to cover flower shows. And matter of fact, just yesterday, 2 days after I got over here, I went over to visit a new community garden where they took an 1800s greenhouse and they've converted it into a place where people can come in and grow seedlings and grow vegetable plants and the stuff that they grow, the little gardens outside that used to be an estate garden, you know, very wealthy landowner's garden. Now it's a community garden where they're growing food to take to food markets. And I actually interviewed an interesting fellow, but we'll talk about that later. How you been?
Man, I've been doing good, man. I think, I don't know when you officially left, but you may have missed the storms that came through and, you know, it'd been down trees and power lines and things everywhere. So
I think my street was the only one in the whole neighborhood that didn't lose power. As a matter of fact, I didn't leave till Monday, but I rode around when we got off the radio program Friday. You know, and I came in through last Thursday night, Friday morning. I walked around. And there's a lot of destruction. I mean, not to diminish people who lost a lot of property and got injured and even some lives lost, but there's a lot of down power lines. Even when I left Monday, almost, you know, half a week later, people that I actually went to my pub, and because nobody has candles anymore, we took our, I don't know if you know this trick, but you could turn the light on your flashlight on your phone and put a plastic bottle of water on top of it, and it glows like a lantern. Did you know that?
No, I did not know that. Okay, that's a new trick for me.
Yeah. Just turn the flashlight and sit on the table and put a, you know, plastic bottle of water on top, and it was kind of creepy, but kind of, it was just like we used to do 120 years ago before we had electricity. But anyway, I know it's summertime. You know, I was traveling on the solstice, and I'm in a place where it's actually daylight 2 hours longer than in Mississippi. The sun doesn't come up here. The sun comes up here just before 5 in the morning, and it doesn't set until 9:30 at night. I mean, the sun is still up.
Wowzers.
Yeah. So, but anyway, there's a whole lot of stuff going on. I've been helping people on the Mississippi Gardening Facebook page, answering emails, and I know a lot of people are having trouble with water issues, too much water, not enough water. The tomatoes have leaf curls, all sorts of bugs and blights, and a lot of people are worried about, you know, how can I get these plants through. That's what you and I are here for, Java. So if folks got stuff they want to talk about with the gardening. Meanwhile, let's start up talking with a fellow in Memphis named Roy. Roy, what you got going on this morning?
Well, good morning, Felder. I got a question for you.
Howdy.
For a couple of years, yeah, I've seen these Asian jumping worms in my vegetable gardens, and I've just wondered, what do you think about them?
Well, these are the worms coming out of the trees?
No, these are in the dirt. And they, when you uncover the dirt, they jump around like crazy.
They're hopping around, earthworms, right? I actually have those too, and I'm not sure. You know, we have this fairly new worm in America called the Asian jumping worm. I don't know if you've heard about those, But they're a real serious issue. Particularly, I saw some a couple of years ago in my friend Roger Swain's garden up in New Hampshire. It is a new type of worm, and when you uncover them, they just flop and flip around. You know, not like worms have always done. These look like they've gone crazy. And like I say, I don't know if we've got them in Mississippi yet, because I don't know how they've gotten here that fast, but they're still beneficial as worms are, but they are so voracious. They eat so much stuff that they actually go through the organic matter and leave land or forest so quick that they're actually causing problems. But there's nothing we can do about them except just enjoy them. So if it is an Asian jumping worm, other than that, it's just earthworms you're thinking, hang on, I don't want to be out here in the sun and heat. So is there something specific about them, though, or are you just trying to run it by somebody?
Well, how do you tell the difference between the Asian variety and our common variety?
That's actually a good question, and I looked that up a couple of years ago because I wasn't sure, and I've forgotten. What I'll do is over the next few minutes, I'm sitting in front of my my laptop, and I'll see if I can find the distinction. It almost doesn't matter, though, Roy, because there's really not anything we can do about them. I mean, practically, there's nothing we can do except just kind of go with this flow. You know, that's one thing, the takeaway I learned is once you got them, you got them. And they're just extra active worms is all.
Gotcha. Okay.
Well, there's nothing to worry about. I mean, there's plenty of stuff to worry about. And this is one of those little irritations and a concern. But, you know, my philosophy has always been, if you can't fix it, flee it, or fight it, let's just flow with it. And this is one of those cases.
Gotcha.
Stay tuned, and I'll do some research and catch me up and share it with y'all.
Great. Thanks.
All righty. Thank you, man. Okay, let's go slide just down the road a little bit to Chico in Oxford. Hey, Chico, how are you doing?
Hey, good morning, y'all. Sorry, I got to yell. I'm hitchhiking on the side of the road between Abbeville and Oxford, and there's cars passing me at a high rate of speed.
Y'all are headed up to the North Mississippi Hill Country Picnic in southern Marshall County. If y'all are, y'all stop and pick me up.
Maybe next time, Chico. You should have gave us a heads up.
I guess so. But I got a question. I'm out here on the side of the highway, and there's all these, I think they call them black-eyed Susans.
Yep.
And I love this time of year because I get to pick them off the side of the road for my redheaded woman, and picking them off the side of the road feels like I'm stealing them from Tate Reeves. But yesterday, yeah. I put some in some returnable Coca-Cola bottles for her, and filled them up with water, and this old man approached me, and he told me, and I figure old men know what they're talking about, but he told me that those kind of flowers do not do well sitting in water, that I shouldn't put water in the bottles. Am I being led astray?
That's true. Not really. A lot of the roadside wildflowers, believe it or not, some of them aren't even native to Mississippi. They've blown in. They've come in with, you know, loads of hay and blown off of railroads and all that. But they grow best in prairie conditions, which is typically is pretty dry in the sun. Think East Texas, Oklahoma, you know, prairie type conditions without good dirt. Think roadside conditions. A lot of these wildflowers grow best in poor, dry soil. You don't see them down in the ditches so much. You see them up on the sides. So
that's right.
Really, the key is look where most of them are growing, and plant them in similar conditions. We got a whole bunch of stuff that grows well down in the ditches that won't grow up on the hillsides. See, so it's a little micro habitat thing. But in general, most of those roadside wildflowers grow. Yeah, yeah.
Are you
digging some up to take home?
Well, I'm picking a bunch of them to take up to the Blues Festival, to the North Mississippi Hill Country Picnic, to put on stage. And if they didn't need water, I didn't want them to put water in them to have it, you know, turn it over on the stage and whatnot. You and Java need to come on up here to the picnic for the bees.
Well, hey, here's the thing. If you're just making flowers, if you're just cutting stems of flowers, yeah, put those in water. But if you're digging up the plants, don't do those. But cut flowers, I'd put them with at least half of the stems in some water to keep them from wilting. Because otherwise, by the time you get a rise, those things are going to be wilted.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, I'm just cutting stems. I'm not fooling with the dirt and everything.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah, that's fine. And by the way, anybody listening who's on that rural stretch road, if you see a guy with a bunch of wildflowers, he's not crazy. Give him a ride.
That's right. You got to go to the picnic. I'll see y'all there.
Okay, see you, Chico. Thanks for calling. By the way, Job, I just did some research, and I found out how you can tell an Asian jumping worm from the regular European night crawlers. A lot of people don't realize that the big worms in our soils are often not native worms. They're from Europe. But the difference is, you know, worms have got they're long and skinny, and they got this little, I don't know what you call it. It's like a ring around them.
Yeah, I was going to say like a wristband.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, the Asian ones, that band goes all the way around like a belt. The ones that we're familiar with, it just goes part of the way around like a saddle. And the other thing is, you pick them up, our worms, the ones we've had a long time, they're kind of slimy feeling. Asian worms are kind of smooth. Now, this is assuming that our caller from Memphis, Roy, wants to get down that close to find out. But, you know, if the ring goes all the way around it, and it's jumping like crazy, and it feels kind of dry as an Asian jumping worm. You know, this should have been one of those questions, answered questions nobody asked, because somebody actually asked this one.
Somebody wanted to know, man.
There you go. Okay, let's slide down to Clinton and talk with Danny. Good morning, Danny. How are you?
Doing good. How are you, sir?
So far, so good.
I dug my iced potatoes yesterday. And some of them were smushy, but about three quarters of them did good. I got about a short roll, about a foot tub full of them. Being I'm half Irish, and a lot of people think the iced potatoes come from Ireland, but you know they don't originate from Ireland.
No, they come from South America.
Right. And there's all kinds of them. Do you know why the Irish hate the English?
Keep in mind, I'm in England right now.
But still, when they had the iced potato blight,
right.
And the English had conquered Ireland, and they had to work on the farm, their own farm for nothing, and they had a little plot of land to grow their own food. And when the iced potato blight came, and they didn't have anything to eat.
The story goes downhill rapidly from there. Believe me, I understand. But you got a pretty decent harvest. Some of them are mushy, I guess, from all the rain we had last week.
Oh yeah, but they did good. Yeah. I just need to plant more next time.
Yeah, and also, I don't know when you planted yours, but in central Mississippi, you know, late February, you know, the potatoes don't like freezes. They don't like hot weather. They like a long, cool growing season, which we don't have in Mississippi. You know, we can still get a freeze in late March that can damage the new growth. So it's going to be a gamble. You got to plant them early enough so they have enough time to make potatoes before it gets too hot, because they start petering out about now. So it takes about 100 days, 3.5 or 4 months to get a good crop. So it's always going to be a race planting them early enough without them freezing, or late enough to still get a harvest before the plant starts. I got just barely more potatoes than I planted, but some people have had real good success.
That was my case. A question. On my cucumbers, my vines, the leaf would just wilt, and then pretty soon the whole vine will die. And
we have, you know, this is something I've been working with home vegetable gardens for 45 years, I guess, a long, long time. And we have a lot of fungi and bacteria in the soil that can cause root rot. if the plant stayed too wet for a little too long or too dry a little bit too long or back to back, they're more susceptible to diseases that they can normally resist. Sort of like we all have cold germs, but we don't have colds. So you just try to stay healthy. But anyway, there's a lot of root diseases, stem diseases, and sometimes it's an insect around the base of the plant. But if it's the whole plant's collapsing, it's going to be a root or lower stem problem. And about all you can do is watch your watering. That's about all you can do.
I saw online that mix hydrogen peroxide in water and water them, and it would kill the fungus and it let them pull it all more water.
Well, it doesn't. Well, there's always something. Every time you hear one of these home remedies, there's a grain of truth in it. But whether it actually really works or not, rarely, most of the time, no. It's just something people do. They're grasping at straws. But it doesn't hurt to do that. But you know, you can't kill a fungus. You know, you can slow it spread, but you can't actually kill a fungus unless you're going to kill your plant too. So anyway, hydrogen peroxide is one of those home remedies. Doesn't hurt to do it, but it doesn't really help either. But, you know, whatever makes people feel better, unless it causes problems, I just let it slide.
I want my cucumbers off my 7-month-old grandbaby that's starting to love to chew on cucumbers because she's cutting teeth.
Yeah. Well, now here's the good news. We have up until in central Mississippi, you have up until the first week in August to plant summer things like cucumbers and tomatoes and all, and still get a harvest before fall. So you can replant, and you may not have as many problems on those that are planted now that soil isn't quite so cold and quite so wet as when you set those out. So they might have gotten off to a kind of a slow start, and the heat is just too much for them. So you know, go ahead and start some more plants.
I have about a month ago. Just to see. Well, I thank you, Elder, for taking up the time.
No, ain't no time. Hey, that's exactly the reason we're here, Danny. Thank you for helping take up me and Java's time, because that's what we're here for.
Now, Feld, I feel like that is another one to add to the list of the home remedies. Had you heard of that, mixing the hydrogen peroxide with water to kill a fungus?
I have. I wrote a column for the Mississippi Press Association. I don't know. A lot of people may not realize, but I have a column that's sent out every week to every weekly and daily newspaper in the state, and the editors can run it. Doesn't cost them anything. It's put out by the Mississippi Press Association. But I just did a column recently on most of the myths that I've heard over at Gary Bachman, Norman Winter, all of us extension horticulture people, we hear it over and over and over. And we're not going to argue with anybody because Aunt Mamie said it's truth. But the fact is, there's a whole lot of stuff people do that just makes them feel better. And it really doesn't hurt anything. So anyway, hey, I want to mention, I actually smuggled a tomato into England in my carry-on luggage.
Wait a minute, Felder. They're going to come looking for you.
There's no evidence left, if you know what I mean. I brought my first big tomato of the year, my very first one. It's starting to turn pink before I left. I said, I can't leave that. So I put it in my carry-on luggage with a handful of peppers, and I brought it. And it's turning so pretty and red. But I smuggled a green tomato to England.
We have a fugitive on our hands, people.
that's right, a miscreant. But by the time anybody comes here, I mean, it turned pure. As a matter of fact, let's run the picture I sent you for on today's podcast. I got a lot of stuff to talk about, and I've got an interview I want to run in just a few minutes. But let's go up to Amory and talk with Janice. Hi, Janice. Good morning.
Good morning.
Howdy. What's up?
I have something eating all of my tender little plants, zinnias, strawberries, even the black-eyed Susans. And I don't think it's a rabbit because I've protected them with chicken wire, and I can't find a grasshopper or what are the cutworms. What can I do?
Oh, that's a good one because, you know, in Mississippi, this time of year, it could be anything, Janice. It could be a rabbit, could also be mice or rats that come out and feed at night because I've had them eat my tomatoes before. So it could be something like that. not much you can do about it except for the plants like strawberries. If you could put some chicken wire over the bed, but, you know, it's not real practical, and chicken wire costs more than strawberries would. But unless you can find a critter, it can't make a recommendation other than some way of some version of fencing them out, either with hardware cloth or insect netting or a fence or something like that. You know, we can't come up with a specific control without knowing what the specific critter is. So the general solution is always some form of barrier, which means fence or chicken wire. And it's not fun, but that's the only practical thing we can do.
But could it be an insect? It's also eating the black-eyed Susan.
Yeah, that sounds more like an insect. I tell you what, if it's an insect doing that, the chances are good it's coming up at night. A lot of caterpillars and things will crawl up at night in the cover of darkness to avoid predators. So what you might want to do is go out, you know, 10:30, 11 o'clock, even midnight, you know, plenty of time after dark with a flashlight and see if you can find one of them. But, sometimes cutworms will stay down the soil in the daytime and come up at night. But you can also dig around the base of the plants, because if they're there, they'll be fairly shallow. They're not going to be deep like earthworms or anything. So you might want to just, you know, scooch around with your finger, see if you can find something. Or let's just check with a flashlight. But you need to wait at least a couple hours after dark, because that's when they come out. And I'm just guessing here.
Okay. And thank you for your advice about the not ridding of strawberries, because my gardenias came back beautifully, more pretty than ever.
Did you prune them hard, or did they just come back on their own?
I did. I pruned them back, yes. But they came back.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
And enjoy your trip in England. It's a gorgeous place, and it amazes me how the flowers are so pretty all the time, because they get so much rain.
Well, they have the same climate as Seattle. It doesn't rain. Every now and then it rains really hard. They say it's chucking it down is what they say, chucking it down. They have hard rains every now and then, but it's usually just short rains, you know. But the difference is it's cool here in the summertime, and it cools down at night. And here's the thing that a lot of people don't realize. They talk about how pretty the flowers look. England is on the same latitude as Nova Scotia. The sun is at a real low angle, and because the sun rays have to go through so much atmosphere, certain colors like blues and greens really pop visually. In Mississippi, the sun is higher up overhead, and the reds and oranges and yellows, the hot colors, tend to glow more. But the further north you go, the crisper and clearer the blues and the greens are. So a lot of times it's just an optical illusion, really.
Well, that explains why all those window boxes in Wales and Ireland and England are just gorgeous all summer long.
They're gorgeous. Partly because it doesn't get hot, partly because it cools down at night, which gives plants a break, partly because the angle of the sun, but partly because a lot of those flowers are artificial. I hate to tell folks that, but there's so many artificial flowers in England.
Oh, my goodness.
But, you know,
well, enjoy the trip, and thank you for your advice.
Appreciate it. Thank you so much. Okay, that was Janice up at Amory. Let's slide down to Neshoba County. Bill, what's going on, man?
Hey, I am following up on your advice last week on my tree. It had a limb fall off of it and it damaged the trunk.
Uh-huh.
And since then, we've had a whole bunch more bad weather, and I had two more limbs fall off and damage the trunk. This is the main trunk of the tree. And I would say just about 75% of the trunk is damaged. So the top is getting some food, but it's, you know, not very much. And I'm wondering if I cut that top off at about 12 feet, aside from the fact that it's going to look a little weird, is that tree going to live, or is that...
Okay. Remind me what kind of tree it was, because I have real short term memory. My old maple tree. You know what a bonsai is. You've seen bonsai plants.
Yeah, sure.
Little plants kept in pots. okay, all you're talking about is a big size bonsai. You know, you're shaping it into a almost like a topiary type thing rather than a tree. And as long as you make a cut pretty close to, let's say where the trunk is broken off, if you cut that part down to just almost flush with a limb that's growing, you know, a strong limb, you're just going to have a sort of a Dr. Seuss looking tree instead of a maple tree. It's going to be characterful rather than tree like. But it's okay to prune plants like this and shape them up. It's just called topiary. But yours is unhappy topiary instead of on purpose topiary.
Right.
So just turn it into an old purpose topiary and let it be, you know, kind of what you see in a spooky old movie or something, and it'll work.
Okay. Well, there's
not much else we can do, you know. As long as you make the cut where it's not a great big flush cut, but as close as you can without leaving much of a stub, it'll heal over pretty quickly. It just could be characterful. Matter of fact, you can actually turn it into something that is a sight to behold. We see this in a lot of old gardens, the botanic gardens, where they've done this to ancient trees, and they're actually kind of cool looking.
Hmm. Okay. I'm glad to know that the tree won't get killed if I cut that much. And
I'm just going to have to live
with people slowing down.
Yeah, well, put your sign out there saying, "Say you're in Neshoba County Topiary." You know, in other words, just go with the flow. You don't have anything to lose. And it may live for 20, 30, 40 years and be more and more interesting, kind of gnarly looking. You know, so and it's okay. We just have to shift the way we look at things.
Okay. I can do that. So.
Okay. I'll give you one kind of a coarse example. I had a little cancer cut off the end of my nose, and it's healed over now. But instead of just being an old guy, I'm an old guy with a boogered up nose now. And I look in the mirror, and I just see old me, white hair growing on my ears, and kind of a wonky shaped nose and all. And I'm just going with that flow. It's just part of getting aging gracefully, is what we call it. That's the way I'm doing it.
Okay. Well, from time to time, people will call me graceful, so I don't know if I want to pile some more stuff on, but I'll give it a try.
There you go. It doesn't hurt. Doesn't hurt, man. Good luck on it, Bill. Send me a before and after picture.
Oh, okay. I can do that. Yeah, it looks pretty ugly right now.
Hey, I've had old dogs that one of their ears wouldn't stand up, and I still loved it. You know what I'm saying?
Hey, I do. I got an old dog that stopped listening to what I have to say, probably because she can't hear, but doesn't stop the way I feel about her.
Not assuming that plants have feelings, but what you want to bet that rather than cut it down, if you just sort of shape it up a little bit, that if your maple had a tail, it would wag it in gratefulness. Good luck on it, man.
Felder, we're coming up on the halfway mark of the show, but we have a full bank of calls, man. They want your advice this morning. But this is what we're going to do. This is what we're going to do so everybody knows, because we have to get your interview in this hour. We're going to talk with Ann from Carpenter, Mississippi, and then we're going to take our cheesy tune break, come back with our interview, which is really, really short. And then we're going to talk with Mike and Corinth, Lynn and Jackson, and the rest of our callers. Okay.
All righty, man. Sounds like a full bank. Let's do it. So let's slide over to Carpenter. Call with Ann. Hey, Ann. Good morning. Thanks for holding.
I am good. Felder, how are you?
So far, so good. Not so bad.
Okay. Look, I have a Japanese, and it begins with an S, tree. The leaves kind of look like a pisellum. And when I was watering the other day, I noticed, like, sawdust around at the bottom.
Yep.
So I'm assuming it's got some worms in it. Does that mean it's
going to
die?
I don't know if it means it's going to die, but there's nothing you can do about it. We don't have any sprays that will penetrate into those holes and around under the bark to get to them. So a lot of times trees can can get this kind of damage, and it compartmentalizes it, and it doesn't really hurt it that much. A lot of times they'll survive with that. If it's a whole bunch of them and it's coming out of little holes, chances are it's going to girdle the tree and not much you can do. If it's possible, you know, like with figs or a whole bunch of trees that have that, you can cut it off below there, and they'll sprout back out just fine. It's just like, you know, getting run over with a pickup truck or cutting it down or hitting it with a lawnmower. A lot of times they can sprout back out, and they'll grow really fast. So if it's a valuable plant, you might consider, if there's a lot of the sawdust, go ahead and cut it below there, and they'll sprout. You've seen people try to cut plants down and sprout back out to the ground. This will do the same thing. It just thin out the new shoots. So only have two or three or four. So it'll be a multiple trunk plant instead of a witch's broom type thing. So that's what I do with my fig. My fig came back perfectly fine.
Yeah, well, it's all the way down at the ground is where I saw the sawdust. So. Oh, well, I hate to lose it because it sure is going to be a pretty tree.
Yeah, well, I wish I could send you a picture, but I had a Cliara shrub. A great, you know, normally it's just a bush by somebody's house, but mine was 80 years old. It was planted when the house was built. And it got killed this past winter, and I cut, it had five main trunks. I cut them off perfectly level, and I put a wayside, I put a round clear glass tabletop on top of it. So I got me a table out in the front yard now with a potted plant on it.
That sounds good. All right. Thank you, Felder.
Okay. Appreciate your call.
And now it's time for Answers to Unasked Questions with Felder Rushing.
Thanks, Java. There's a whole lot of people who right now at garden centers, they've got these little insect hotels or boxes with hollow tubes and straws and stuff and butterfly houses, and they're really cute. So I asked a fellow who is a top backyard pollinator, top expert in Great Britain about this during our interview yesterday, and George Pilkington, who's a certified, he's a wildlife specialist, and here's what he said. It's only about a two-minute interview. I thought it'd be interesting for folks to see what he thinks. And by the way, the key word is rubbish.
Okay, George, you're not afraid to call things like you see it, but you struck a nerve in your talk when you said that insect hotels, that they're just a bunch of what we in Mississippi call a hooey. What do you think about bug or bee hotels?
Well, there's major differences between bees and bugs, so I wouldn't know which bugs you're on about. But if you want something to attract bees, make sure it just attracts bees and nothing else. You don't want earwigs and spiders and other creatures, other insects going in there and will predate upon the bees that use these bee hotels. Hotel is somewhere where you go on holiday or you stay for a few days. Some of these solitary bees will live in there 9-10 months. Problem with many of them is there's all kinds of pests that could be inside, and there's pollen mite, for example. They can live in a bee hotel.
We have lizards who would just lap them up.
The bees.
Yeah.
Well, put them out of the way of the lizards, really.
Yeah. So when you see one of these bee hotels, things with little straws and all like that.
A load of rubbish.
You call it bee cemetery, I think.
Bee cemetery, yeah. It's a bee nest box, let's call it what it is, not a bee hotel. If you want a decent nest box, you've got to make sure that you're looking after the bees and you're protecting them from pests and predators. Why are you putting it out if you're not helping them? A lot of the pests will be inside the tubes or inside the cavities, and they'll just eat everything that's in there.
Yeah.
And you won't know that.
Well, one of the things that I've been doing is just piling old logs and branches and things up in a row. A lot of our bees will make nests in those.
There will be pests in there, and some of them pests can live in there for up to 3 years and just waiting for the next unfortunate bee to go and use it.
So basically these bee hotels are mostly just nice-looking garden accessories.
Greenwashing, absolute greenwashing, yeah. People think they're doing good, well, in fact, they're doing more harm.
Okay, and by the way, Java, I don't know if you picked up on that accent. If it sounded like some old Beatle interviews, that is a classic Liverpool accent. Anybody from Great Britain will instantly say, that's a Scouser there, Liverpudlian. But anyway, he's saying those bee hotels, they're interesting. They're nice little accents, but they're really not that great for bees. And this is a fellow who's been studying it for 40 years. So anyway, I hope this answered a question that nobody really asked. Are all these things really worth it? And I'm thinking, no, not really, but they sure are pretty. So anyway, let's go to Jackson and talk with Lynn. Hey, Lynn, good morning.
Good morning, Felder. How are you?
Fine. What's going on?
I have a friend. She's in her late 70s. She's moved to Jackson from the West Coast to retire. She has a nice little house in a nice neighborhood. And yeah, really. The problem she's having right now is she has wisteria in her front yard. They're the kind that have been cut back really hard. They're like 6 feet tall, and most of them are beginning to sprout out again. But one was hit really hard by that freeze in May.
Yeah.
So it.
Yeah.
Dead,
what kind of plant was it again? What kind of plant was it?
Crepe myrtle. Sorry. Crepe
yeah,
myrtle.
I got you. Got you. Right.
Okay.
So what's she worried about?
It's like 6 foot tall, dead limbs, maybe 3-4 inches across. She has a gentleman,
right.
I say gentleman, who is helping her with her yard, and he has offered to spray these and see if he can't get it to come back. Now, they've done that little bark shedding thing that crepe myrtle do, and most of them look like they're coming along, but this one is dead to the ground. But it is beginning to sprout out at the roots.
Right.
So I'm telling her that her best bet is to just cut it down and start over. She's a little reluctant. She's, you know, she wants to save it, and I'm telling her there's nothing to save.
Yeah.
But in her late 70s, not particularly good health, I'm wondering if she should just have that dug up and start over again, or will it grow quickly enough to be at least interesting in the next couple of years?
Yeah. Well, we have to balance several things here. First, is not the horticulture. The first is she's 70. She's reluctant to cut it down to get rid of it, and that's as important as anything. We had a lot of crepe myrtles all over the place that were actually killed or seriously damaged that normally can take a winter time, but they were seriously damaged this year. And some are coming out very thin. Some are coming out none at all. Some are just perfectly fine. So it's no telling why or which ones would do well. But to answer the horticulture question, you can cut a crepe myrtle down to the ground to try to get rid of it. Many people have tried, and they sprout back out. So it can come back out perfectly fine. And if she wants to do that, she'll have results this year. It's even possible that the new sprouts could bloom this year, but certainly next year. But when you cut that far down, you'll get a lot of sprouts. And what she would want to do is come back this winter and thin them out to the strongest 3 or 4 or 5 and let those become new main trunks. And they will grow really fast because the roots are intact. The roots are going to push that new growth. So it'll take 3 or 4 weeks, maybe a little bit more than a month for the new growth to come out, but it will really, really jump. And you said there's already some coming out anyway. So I would just thin it out to the strongest 3 or 4 or 5 and let those become new trunks. And it won't be balanced. You know, won't match the others, but they'll do fine. They really will. So whether to go that route or to start over something else because symmetry is, it depends on whether symmetry is more important than sympathy, if that makes sense. So if she wants symmetry,
right.
I just get rid of put something else out there.
One quick thing. She's not familiar with the crepe myrtle. So it's got that bark peeling off thing that it does in the spring.
That's normal.
I need to reassure her of that. Okay.
Good. The word is exfoliating bark. It's called exfoliating. It does that on purpose. I mean, that's normal. There's several different plants that have exfoliating bark, and crepe myrtle is one of them. So she doesn't need to worry about that. Tell her, if she's from the West Coast, tell her it's like the eucalyptus trees on the West Coast. They do that too.
All right. Okay, good.
So how are you doing? Thank you so much. Okay, man. Good luck. I appreciate you helping her out too.
Take care.
Okay, you bet. Okay, let's slide over to way up to the icebox to Corinth. Hey, Mike, what's going on?
Hey, I just had three observations. The previous gentleman kind of correlates to that. We had two 7 foot tall Laura Pedlums that we thought were dead from the frost, and I called you and you told me to cut them back, and I cut them back east to 8 inches from the ground, and they're about 2 feet tall now. They're doing fine. So,
yeah, you probably have too many. You might want to thin some of those sprouts out so you don't have too many, like a witch's broom.
Right.
And the energy that'll go to what you cut. Yeah, and go ahead and do that soon, and the energy that would have gone to what you cut off will go into what's left. It'll grow even better.
I will. And the other thing, about 5 years ago, we started getting Japanese beetles. And I have been noticing our crepe myrtles, their blooms is one thing they really liked. And I've kind of got a theory. I want to see what you thought about it. It seems like the crepe myrtles have adapted to the timing, and they're blooming later till the beetle goes back into the ground, kind of self-defense. I don't know what you thought about that, but I just kind of thought it was curious.
That's a good theory, and there is a lot of scientific evidence that plants will adapt to pest pressures. I mean, there's a lot of evidence that we didn't know 15 years ago. They've got some important, really good studies that show that. But at the same time, you know, Japanese beetle. Now, we're talking about the kind of iridescent green ones or those brown ones?
The iridescent green.
Yeah. See, those are a major problem. They're a major problem in Michigan and Minnesota. Yeah, cold doesn't bother them at all. You know, they're a huge problem. They're more of a problem the further north you go than we have down here. So it may just be a little coincidental, but, you know, you got to keep in mind the Japanese beetles and crepe myrtles are the same part of the world. They sort of grew up together. And, you know, you can't have, just like you can't have ladybugs without having aphids for them to eat. You can't really have these June bug things without crepe myrtles and things for them to eat. So it's sort of a hand-in-hand thing. And for what it's worth, birds eat a lot of those beetles. So they acted part of the ecosystem. Bottom line is, there's not much you can do about it.
I'm reluctant to spray my chase trees because the bumblebees love chase trees. I hate to. The beetles seems to like those blooms too. But my last question, for some reason, we don't have any hummingbirds. And I'm just curious. We did have a few a month ago, but none now.
Well, this is for the past 40-something years. You know, I hear that a lot of people have a lot of them. A lot of people don't have any. But this time of year, they're going out there nesting, and they don't quite come to feeders unless they're looking for protein, for little spiders and aphids and things like that. So a lot of times, they sort of disappear from our feeders temporarily in the late spring and early summer, but they come back. And a whole lot of them that we see in the springtime are just passing through. You know, the hummingbirds that we see in April and May are they make it all the way up to Pennsylvania and Vermont and stuff. See, so a lot of them are just passing through, and those that stick around, a whole lot of them are just, they're making their nests right now. But there's plenty of them out there. I see a lot of people posting pictures on the Mississippi Facebook, posting little videos of the hummingbirds. So they're out there. It's just a matter of, like going fishing. You know the fish are out there, but sometimes they ain't biting what you put on the hook.
Well, that's all I have. I appreciate your information.
It's a good observation, though. Thank you very much. Appreciate it, Mike. Now we're going to go from... Thank you so much. Let's slide all the way down the Gulf Coast and talk with Keith. Good morning, Keith.
Hey, good morning. I'm glad to hear you and wanted to wish you a happy birthday.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. And wanted to let you know the storytelling show that they did down here last night for MPB was great. And you were spoken about very highly and friendly-like, so just so you know that. Absolutely.
And you said, and friendly-like.
That's exactly right. They were all very, very pleased with you. But anyway, I could go on with that. Hi to Miss S. Met her at the Master Gardener Convention in Biloxi several years ago. Talked to her about getting thrown a few quid to get into a Springsteen show there in London. But my question, Felder, is I took down that 400-year-old oak tree, and I chipped it up, and I put some 10-10-10 on top of it. Can I put St. Augustine directly over the top of those chips, or what should I do?
No, St. Augustine grows in, it grows roots in just dirt. And the sod that you put out there has got to be in direct contact with real dirt, not caught up in mulch or not in thatch or weeds or anything like that. It really needs to be in contact with dirt. So if you're going to do that, I would haul in a little bit of real topsoil, you know, the stuff we call dirt, the stuff you get under your fingernails, and spread a little bit of that over the top so that the grass can have something denser that its roots can grow into. And then once it gets established in that, it can grow down into the bark mulch beneath there. But it needs to start off growing in contact with something that's a lot denser than bark mulch.
So dirt. Okay, that's all I really needed. And, oh, yeah, and I'll close with, we had a lot of conversations with about Dr. Dirt at the Storyteller Show last night, and it was fun. But thanks for your time, Joe. I appreciate you.
Thank you so much, Keith. I appreciate that.
Okay.
And Java, I don't know if a lot of people, but every now and then we have reference Dr. Dirt. When I first started the MPB, my co-host was a guy from Edwards. He called himself Dr. Dirt. And for four and a half years, he was my co-host. He passed away, sadly, a few years ago. And I just had a book that came out last spring called Maverick Gardeners. And the subtitle is Dr. Dirt and Other Determined Independent Gardeners. Heck of a gardener, no horticulture training, but a better gardening skills than this old horticulture has. He could grow anything at just plain D-I-R-T dirt. Anyway, so if you wondered who Dr. Dirt was, you can actually go to my blog, philderushing.blog, and I've got a little essay about Dr. Dirt. And he was a fantastic creature.
And there's also some clips, Felder, if anybody wants to do a YouTube dive.
Oh, yeah.
You guys were featured, I believe it was on Mississippi Roads a couple years ago. And, it's a great feature with Dr. Dirt and yourself.
Yeah, right after Hurricane Katrina, he and I got on MPB and solicited plant donations. And people brought a whole bunch of plants to the MPB studio there in Jackson. We loaded up my old pickup truck and took them down there and shared them with other people. Planted some at a school garden, you know, where people are displaced. So we actually collected plants. We call it recoastalization. That's a word that he termed, a word that he coined.
That's nice.
So, man, I got a question for you. I know you're not a tomato eater, so you're the perfect person to ask this, but I've got this almost ripe red tomato. What do you think I ought to do with it? Throw it in a cat or slice it into a sandwich or put it in some soup? What would you do if somebody gave you a tomato and you had to do something with it and other than just throw it away?
If you
don't like them.
Yeah, if I had to do something with it, I would maybe put it in like a pasta or some tomato soup. I'm not adverse to tomato soup.
Okay, well, sometime, maybe next week or two, we can, one of those answers, the question I ask is, what is that jelly-looking stuff in a tomato anyway? But anyway, it's been kind of rock and rolling today, Java.
Yes, it has. We're at the end of the show, and it came really fast.
Okay, well, it's time for me to do what I do best on Friday afternoon, because it's 4 o'clock in the afternoon for me. It's time to head to a pub. It might be hot in Mississippi, but the beer in England is warm. Anyway, I'm horticulturist Felder Rushing. We've been just chatting with folks. I don't know everything. Some stuff I wish I didn't know. If you have questions during the week, go to felderrushing.blog and click that email me thing.
This is an MPB Think Radio podcast. To hear previous shows, visit mpbonline.org or download the MPB Public Radio app to listen on your iPhone or Android phone on demand.